think Tevez going to Juventus, what a coup that was for me. I mean,
on a head-to-head battle, Atletico Madrid can do more damage to Barcelona than the other way around.
Either he's really blind or he's fixing the match. I can't see it any other way.
I'm trying to get Sir Bob on my side here by saying City will win the Premier League.
It is an upset. You would expect Man United to go and win there.
Over $1 billion was paid in transfer fees between the clubs in Europe.
It's football. It's damn football. Like Ferguson said, football. Bloody marvellous.
Yeah, well, the celebration was, I can't believe I just scored against Mexico.
At one point, Parma, I think it's only like 224 players under contract.
So they're going to throw me out of here, fellas. You're going to get me arrested on your show.
If you're a serious talent, you're going back and you're playing for Santos. You know, you're going back to play for, like in Argentina, for River Plate or Boca Juniors. Or you're going to Europe.
He looked like the Ryan Giggs of old. He was more creative than any player on the pitch. He made Mata look stupid. He made Rooney look silly.
Now, the Premier League is what the most exciting league out there. I think it's probably the best marketed league without a question.
When you look at the draw for the Champions League, you kind of say, well, all the pieces kind of fell into place for everybody except City.
I am your host, Joe Uccello.
Sir Bob, Mike Orr. My co-host, Rob Rojas.
My trusted co-host, Ben the Machine.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to episode 220 of Low Limit Football on this 15th of October, 2018, on the Beyond the Pitch Media Network. I am your host, Joe Uccello, and tonight we ask if the fastest man in the world can score goals in football, and can he get called up to the Jamaican national team? Two giants in international football have been on the downswing. One of them just turned around and won their first match in a while, but the other one certainly has not. What does winning mean for one and continued losing mean for the other? We'll discuss. And we're going to look at the big coaching change in France this weekend, what it means to the outgoing coach, what it means for the possible incoming coach who is finally coming home. We're going to discuss this and much, much more with our good friend from Guardian Australia, Mr. Ante Jukic, who will be joining us in about 5 seconds. First, let me get my co-host in here, Mr. Roberto Rojas. How are you tonight, my friend, if you can hear me?
I can hear you fine and well, and I will ask you this, Joe, the million-dollar question. If you're a 19-year-old youngster playing at one of the top academies in the world and a reporter asks you Manchester City or Barcelona, what is your answer?
Juve. That's my answer. I know what you're referring to. Mr. Mattia De Ligt, who was asked if he would go to City or Barcelona, and he said that he was going to stay at Ajax, or that would be his preferred place. And it's, you know, the kid's got a future in politics, I'd say, don't you think?
You know, that's the way I would start them young. Start them young.
Yeah, I guess so. So let's jump into it. We're going to kind of take a little departure from our normal show tonight. Normally we would have trivia, we would have opening thoughts coming up first, but because of the significant time difference, we're joined immediately by Guardian Australia's Ante Jukic, who's here tonight. Ante, welcome to the show. How are you tonight, man?
I'm very well. Good evening, gentlemen. I hope you're well.
Good. I'm glad you could join us tonight. I'm going to jump into it real quick. As I alluded to in the monologue right off the bat, that we've had two giants of international football really on downward swings, one of them extending for over a year at this point, one of them really falling on their face at the World Cup. And I'm referring to Italy and Germany. Now, Italy takes a 92nd minute goal by Berardi to come up with a 1-0 victory over Poland and all but assure themselves of staying in Group A of the International Champions League or the Champions League. Yeah, I know it's so confusing at this point. But Germany suffering a 3-0 defeat, and by some accounts, the match wasn't even that close. What do you think of Germany at this point? What do you think this also means for Jürgen Löw, who has managed to stay on after Germany really fell on their face in the last World Cup?
I don't know. I think perceptions on Germany are misguided to a degree. I didn't even before the World Cup, I found them to be very susceptible in certain phases of play, and I didn't think they were, you know, ready for a deep run at that tournament. You saw in that German Cup final where Ante Rebic burnt Mats Hummels for pace, and that's something that transfers to the national team. His recovery pace is something that's declining at this stage of his career. He's still a very good player with the ball at his feet, and he's very comfortable, and he's still one of the best in the world at that in that aspect of the game. But with a midfielder like Toni Kroos, who doesn't really have much defensive responsibility in front of a defender that doesn't have very good recovery pace, they're very susceptible on the counter. And that is something that we saw at the World Cup, and that is something that we've seen against France when they played when they opened the UEFA Nations League, and that's also something that we saw against the Netherlands. Like, this is, we're seeing a pattern here, and the fact that people haven't really come across to this has more to do with them than it does with Germany, to be honest.
Do they regret alienating Mesut Ozil at this point?
I think that's a very regrettable situation, and I think it's masked the root cause of, let's say, tactical problems that exist in German football. And you know, when you look at how Özil was treated, how Leroy Sané, for example, was treated, how Toni Kroos, you know, publicly called him out. Yeah, I think all of this masks the very, like I said, the root cause that lies with, you know, Hummels and Kroos, and needing to have very specific players around them. And with Jogi Löw's experimentation, with, you know, playing Kimmich as a central midfielder, playing Timo Werner on the left wing, and playing Marc Uth as it was against the Netherlands, as a striker, as a pivot up front, I don't think that solves the root problem.
You know, Anthony, I'm just going to jump in real quick and, you know, mention Germany just real quick. I mean, obviously, you know, one of the big things that, you know, I think more from a managerial perspective is obviously Jogi Löw. You know, I believe he extended his contract like a month before the World Cup. Right. Do you feel that was a mistake that Germany should have made, considering the bad form that they eventually would get into in the World Cup and now? Or do you feel that, you know, they're left with no choice? Because, you know, I think with all the great German managers that are out there, I mean, you can't just simply just, sack him that early on when you still have a potential qualification to Euro 2020.
Look, I think it would be very, very brave, to put it loosely, to let go of Jogi Löw to, like, preempt this situation. I think it's something that is, aside from the tactical problems, there is a very, a mental, or there is a morale or an interpersonal problem that exists within the German camp, and that's something that is manifested very quickly. I'm okay with keeping Löw on. That there's something, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think he's perfect for international football because he is, after all, a fluid thinker, and he is someone who trusts his players, who believes in his players. I don't think necessarily something that should be eradicated from a national team. So yes, it is a gamble, don't get me wrong, but I think it's fine to keep him on.
No, absolutely. I think that given the experience that he's gotten, given the, you know, everything that he's done over the last 12 years, I think it would be wise to, you know, keep him there and, you know, see what goes from there. Now, obviously, I want to shift gears to, obviously, a player who, you know, I'm sure you're familiar of and obviously has made a lot of news recently, and that's Usain Bolt. No, he didn't race in Australia, he didn't race in Melbourne or Sydney or anything like that, but he's on a team in Australia. But now, because of that trial, there have been some new news reporting that he is set to go to a team in Europe. That, you know, and it's funny because I was looking at a tweet recently regarding this, that it's a team with Champions League aspiration, that it's in Europe, they have new owners, and you would think to yourself, you know, that they're based in Southern Europe, upcoming final, top flight front runner. You think to yourself, okay, where could that be? Would it be in Spain? Would it be in Italy? Would it be in Portugal? Nope, it's all the way in Malta at Valletta FC. I mean, you know, Antti, I mean, what more can you get from that? And, you know, what's the latest coming out of Australia regarding Usain Bolt's future? And, you know, what is the perception that Australian fans are having of this athlete, I would say?
To begin with, I'll talk about perceptions within the Australian public and the Australian footballing media, because football in this country, like America, it lives in a world all of its own. It's like a complete bizarro world when you take into context the world that is global football and everything that exists within that, you know, ecosystem. you have two schools of thought when it comes to Bolt. There are those who absolutely recognize his marketing potential and the money that would bring in, the ticket sales, the TV ratings, and the positive impact that would come from that. And then you have on the other side of the spectrum, you have your purists who believe it is nothing more than a gimmick, and it is a complete bastardization of what should be, football in Australia. Like everything, the truth is always somewhere in between. I think Usain Bolt, as who's someone in his early 30s now, with all due respect to him, I think it's fantastic that he's willing to try new things and willing to fail. That's something that's that's underappreciated in this situation. He's putting his name and his neck out there on the line, and that's something that requires a lot of bravery, a lot of gut. And I'll be honest though, he's not the greatest footballer. The brace he scored on Friday night was against a select team of amateurs from that region in northern Sydney. And his conceptual framing of the game when he doesn't have the ball, like the movements he has to make, the energy that he has to make those movements, leaves a lot to be desired, irrespective of his athletic prowess. He's the greatest sprinter of all time. But you have to eliminate that from the fact that he's playing football, because it's an entirely different form of physical exertion, of energy expenditure, because you have to be more explosive. You have to be quicker over the first 5 to 10 meters instead of striding out to 20 to 30 meters or 100 meters. It's a different sport, and then you take into account the position that he's going to play. What people don't even know what position Bolt is going to play. I find that kind of perverse. But then again, when you take into account the ticket sales and the TV ratings, who's going to watch Usain Bolt be a goalkeeper, or who's going to watch Usain Bolt be a right back or a centre back? No, they're going to want to watch him score goals. And it's a very interesting discussion when you take into context the developmental malaise that exists within Australian football. When you extrapolate this scenario, it's very interesting to ask, what does Australian football want to be?
No, absolutely. I mean, just kind of a follow-up to this, does this actually raise the interest of Australian football now because of, considering the bravery and the sense of Usain Bolt coming to Australia and play professional football? I mean, does this raise the interest of the league in a way?
This is the thing. Like, yes, it absolutely will raise the interest, but what kind of interest will it raise?
No, absolutely. I agree 100%.
I think that's the... from a league standpoint, they're fine. Money will roll in because, people will watch on TV, he'll be on headlines, they'll get exposure just for the sole fact that, the world's greatest sprinter is playing football in Australia. I don't think there's going to be, a disparity between what is promoted, the expectation, and the reality that exists, that he is just a developing footballer like anyone coming through, with a very truncated timeline with respect to someone who's coming through at the age of 18 or 19. His ceiling is going to be confined, let's be realistic. And I think it's great that he's playing football and he's taking a chance at this stage of his career, and he has absolutely every right to leverage his name and marketability into a lucrative. That's the right of any athlete if someone's willing to pay. I think as a footballing public, I think we have to temper expectations to a degree.
Mm-hmm. No, 100%.
And then you take into account the news that just came out from ESPN that Valletta would be willing to give him a contract, which is different to what has existed for the time being at Central Coast, where they've offered him an indefinite trial. If you're going to offer someone, like Bolt, something more substantial, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. over the next couple of weeks, because the season does start this week after all.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. And we're just going to have to wait and see. Now, obviously, let's go shift gears to something a bit more stable. And obviously, I'm going to talk about your beloved, no, not your beloved Australia, but your beloved Croatia. You know, obviously, a couple months since that brutal World Cup final loss against France, but obviously, you know, did the whole country proud and, you know, brought in a major superstar in Luka Modric, you know, obviously, you know, was the main star, you know, won the golden ball, right, deservedly, you know, won the best player in UEFA, the UEFA Men's Player of the Year award, and the best FIFA Men's Player. I know you're such a huge advocate of him, and now we have the final trophy, you know, the final individual trophy, I would say, and perhaps the most important one, it's the Ballon d'Or. Now, obviously, there has been a lot of debate now because of him being the first person to break that whole stronghold that Messi and Ronaldo had for the last decade or so. Do you feel that he is still, rightly so, the best player in the world? And, you know, biased aside, you know, does he deserve this Ballon d'Or given the fantastic year that he had, not just at Real Madrid, but also for the Croatian national team at the World Cup?
I'm going to come back to something that Ivan Rakitic said recently. Like, Lionel Messi is different to all the others. There is something that exists in his mere technical aptitude that other players can't do. But this, to a degree, ignores the kind of impact that Luka Modric has. I'm not going to say now, oh, Ivan Rakitic is wrong, or you know, any player is wrong. Every person has the right to their own opinion. But Luka Modric's, the nature of Luka Modric's impact is something I've never seen before. And you look at great midfielders of the past, like or of the recent past, like Xavi or Andrea Pirlo, like they're not as complete. And the nature of his control on matches, which was something that we saw as a zenith at the World Cup, it's unprecedented. You look at the way that, you know, Real Madrid won the last two Champions League finals, and the manner in which they were able to completely suffocate Juventus and Liverpool, respectively, it all came down to the fact that Luka Modric was a player who could quite simply kick the ball, be it with dribbling, be it with passing, be it with, you know, be it with his movement. And I think the nature of his control is different to Messi, but the nature of his control and impact is light years ahead of any other midfielder in the world, and he should be at least in the discussion with Messi. Like, to, you know, paraphrase Antoine Griezmann, he's legitimately someone who eats at Lionel Messi's table. But that's what makes this Ballon d'Or so interesting. When you take into account Iniesta probably should have won in, you know, 2011. Wesley Schneider had a very good shout in 2010. I think this represents our very conceptual framing of football as a sport, and how we see, you know, how we, you know, let's say quantify performance and how we view indicators of performance. Because Luka Modric isn't someone who fills the stat sheet, to use a basketball, you know, phrasing. He's not someone who is going to score a lot of goals or even garner a lot of assists. But here's the part. Before the assists, he's the player who gets fouled in order for a team to keep the ball, in order for them to apply pressure on the other team and relieve pressure on, you know, on his teammates. Yeah, I think he absolutely has deserved a Ballon d'Or, you know, be it in the past 3 years. But I think the achievement that comes with the World Cup only further, let's say, solidifies his claim to that. And I think he should win the Ballon d'Or this year.
Now, before we let you go, Ante, I do want to jump in here. I do want to ask you one more question about the Croatian national team in the UEFA, Nations League. Obviously, currently sitting third in Group 4 with Spain and England in front of them. They do have two matches left in the competition.
Mm-hmm.
At Spain at home and then England at Wembley on November 15th and 18th. Do they have an opportunity here with the competition being as tough? I mean, you know, Spain was exposed earlier today in the 3-2 loss to England. Obviously, England had a wonderful showing this match, but these two teams played to a 0-0 draw on the first match day for Croatia. Can Croatia turn this around and not get relegated into Group B of the Nations League?
I know I'm going to sound overly cynical here, but I don't think it matters all that much, you know, if they get relegated or not, or even like it's the Nations League after all. I would rather they put up qualify for Euro 2020 and put a good performance there than you know waste or expend energy in something that, although UEFA have promoted it as such, they're still friendlies. They're still only opportunities to learn. They're not necessarily primarily competitive. Although you want to, you know, perform well against high quality opposition, which I think Croatia will do. They still have a game in hand, and in that, yeah, I think they will win at least one of those matches. But I think the most important thing for Croatia is to learn what they want to be in this, you know, post World Cup, post retirement vacuum. The biggest talking point for me has been Dalic pushing Ante Rebic as the striker, and what that represents, you know, within the framework of the team and the players around him. It's clear that Dalic wants a player who can press, who to be a defensive forward specifically, and he's kind of reticence to play Andrej Kramaric, who was probably Croatia's most complete forward from a technical standpoint. And he played him on the wing this morning again, on the left wing this morning against Jordan in a 2-1 win. I think Croatia has a lot of figuring out to do from a tactical standpoint in order to maximize, you know, the, let's say, arguably the best player in the world in Luka Modric.
does this affect the play of Mario Mandzukic and what he offers to the team going forward?
Look, the thing about Mandzukic, I was always a bigger fan of Kramaric because of what he could do, what he brought to the table. But what Mandzukic does, he had a very specific skill set. He was very limited from a technical standpoint, but from an interpersonal standpoint, from a mere competitive standpoint, he was a warrior, and he was able to galvanize the players around him in tougher scenarios, in arduous moments. And that was something that we saw even in this World Cup. And if there is anything that is going to be, like, although that kind of play isn't someone who can be easily replaced from a mental standpoint, his attributes are something that can be replaced or even be improved upon with someone like Kramaric. But it will take playing certain players around him, because I don't think someone like Rebic is compatible in that respect. If you play Rebic, you're going to have to play certain players like, you know, a Pašalić or a Perišić. Or if you play someone like Kramaric, you're going to have to play players like Nikola Vlašić or Josip Brekalo or Marko Piazza. I think the most important thing that Croatia has going forward is, you know, while Luka Modric and Ivan Rakitic stay, is optionality. I think that's the most important thing. And that's what Croatia still has.
I couldn't agree with you more, without a doubt. So, Ante, I want to thank you for coming on the show, joining us this morning where you are. And we look forward to having you back again very, very soon.
Thank you very much for having me. I very much enjoyed it. Awesome. Have a good one.
Thank you so much.
And that was Ante Jukic from Guardian Australia joining us. And I apologize for the microphone problems that we've been having today. Rob and I have been working through them, but hopefully we'll get them all evened out and fixed up here in the post-record. So, Rob, I know we didn't do opening thoughts yet. I do want to jump in on a trivia question for you, right, my friend?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, so I'm going to stick with the Women's World Cup at this point, because the United Ooh. States Women's National... little curveball here for you tonight. So the U.S. Women's National Team qualified for the World Cup, the eighth time they've qualified for the World Cup, which accounts for all of them. They are one of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 teams that have qualified for all 8 Women's World Cups. So I've given you the United States. Can you give me the 5 other teams that have qualified for all of the tournaments?
Okay, got it.
So we'll give you that answer in a few minutes. Let's do opening thoughts real quick here tonight. And tonight, the opening thoughts surrounds what's going on in Monaco. Thierry Henry stepping in, coming home to one of the clubs that he started out with, stepping in for Leonardo Jardim, who was let go on Thursday. Rob, you know, I look back on this. I feel bad for Jardine on this one. He's a coach. He's a wonderful coach, great with youth, good with a lot of talent, and has really done a great job with this team. Monaco making that deep, deep run in the Champions League 2 years back. Really the end result of a massive fire sale in Monaco. We see this happen, you know, every few years to a decently funded French side, and Monaco being the ones this year. And Jardine was let go in place of Thierry Henry, who's going to come over from the Belgian national team. You know, what do you expect out of Thierry Henry moving forward, especially given the propensity of this Monaco side to start unloading these players, that what they've been doing for the past, I'd say, 12 to 18 months?
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, I guess Henry isn't a novice. I kind of want to actually maybe, you know, even parallel this to Zinedine Zidane. You know, obviously a coach who coached both in the youth leagues of Real Madrid, I think at Castilla, and then moved on as an assistant for Carlo Ancelotti, and then moving on to the first team. When you look at Thierry Henry, you know, obviously a manager, you know, I believe he managed the under-19s at Arsenal before then becoming the assistant coach of Roberto Martinez for the Belgian national team over the last 2 years. So certainly, I think now, I think he's much more prepared. I think he's understood of how this managerial stuff works. I mean, when it comes to, you know, what he's going to be able to do at Monaco, it's a thing we don't know, because, you know, this is obviously something that he's being put into literally right there, you know, trying to save a side that's obviously in the Champions League, in Liga, trying to save themselves from, you know, doing a good reversal in this sense. But I feel that perhaps, you know, he has that mentality. Now, I think he has the potential to really do something, and that's the big question, you know. How much of everything that he's learned with Arsenal, with Roberto Martinez at Belgium, how can he put that into an actual top-five league like France and try to do something there? When it comes to Jardine, I mean, Joe, I mean, I'll just say this single-handedly. I mean, whoever gets Jardine, whatever team in the world that it may be, I mean, they're going to be lucky that they have a manager like him. Such a class manager, you know, very good with youth, as you mentioned. And so I feel that whoever gets such a quality manager, and, you know, I kind of do feel bad for him because of the fact that, you know, he wasn't given too much time. You know, obviously the string of results was really bad. You know, had only won one game this season so far in Liga. But I feel that, you know, he still has that potential. He's still a quality manager, as we've seen over the past few years, that whoever gets him will not be disappointed.
No, I agree with you 100%. I don't think they'll be disappointed at all. And for me, on the radar, you look at the instability right now at Manchester United. You look at the instability at Real Madrid. You look at the instability at Bayern Munich. Is he a coach that is ready to take that step to the next level and be one of those big-time managers of one of those big-time teams? I mean, this is a guy that's proven that he can succeed in the Champions League, so why not move into one of those spots at one of the giant clubs in the world?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that would be something really big for him and for the clubs to get such a manager like him. But I really don't know. That's the thing. I mean, I would hope that he does get a job real quick, because I enjoy watching his side, you know, play and, you know, that kind of stuff. But I really don't know. That's the thing. You know, does he take a sabbatical or does he just jump right in? I think, given the fact that he's such a worker, such a hard worker, that he wants to get into, you know, those type of jobs. But, you know, it's really tough to say, honestly, Joe. I mean, would you be willing to say that he would go in straight to a managerial job, be it at one of those clubs that are really struggling at this point?
That's the thing. I don't know. You know, it's one of those things where I think he's good enough. The question is does somebody else have enough faith to add him to the list? Because that's going to be the key. If someone has enough faith to get him, to give him that job, then yeah, I think he will actually do well. But somebody's got to take that leap of faith, and I don't know that the Real Madrids and the Manchester Uniteds of the world are ready to do that, especially at Man U, where they've, quote-unquote, taken that leap of faith at David Moyes. You know, they've done that. They've been down that road a few years ago, and I don't know that would be a good job, you know, for him coming off of the Monaco job. So I think he could be successful, but I don't know that those teams will offer him that possibility. That's my two cents.
Definitely.
So let's move on. Let's hit a couple of our other topics, because and again, I apologize for the sound quality. I'm yelling as best as I can. Let's go to what could have been, Rob, right? Story broke this week that Messi was offered triple his salary, and that the head coach of this team was actually talked to about this, and in the end, Messi turned it down because he does not want to leave Barcelona, and that's Manchester City. According to the president of Manchester City, Khaldun Al-Mubarak, they offered him 3 times his wages to come to Manchester City back in, I believe, 2016, Rob, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yep.
But at that time, Messi turned it down and stayed at City. Rob, what could have been at Manchester City if Messi went?
No, what could have been? I mean, certainly would have probably, we're talking about a Champions League, or, yeah, we're probably talking about a treble-winning, a quadruple-winning side right now. But no, I mean, I think that was always the end. I mean, the one thing that does piss me off more, and I think, Joe, we've talked to this ad nauseum for so many times, is the fact that he rejected this so-called offer because many people thought that he wasn't going to adapt quickly in the Premier League, more physical and much more different than it is in Spain. And I think that's absolutely ridiculous. And Joe, you and I can completely agree with this. You could put Messi in any league in the world, and he'll easily score 30 to 40 goals in the season. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I mean, the naysayers that are out there, they're saying, oh, you know, he plays in La Liga's soft. La Liga's won, what, 10 of the last 11 European titles? Let's be honest, man. He's doing it in the best league in the world, and I think that he will do it anywhere. I think that's, you know, we're talking about Cristiano Ronaldo, we're talking about Lionel Messi, we're talking about a lot of these types of players, Neymar, right? I don't think they're going to be hindered by the league that they're in. And I think we'll stop that there for a second. Some audio kicked in there. But, you know, well, he's not going to be stopped by any one particular league. I think what we're seeing now with Cristiano Ronaldo is that we've got some growing pains, but what he's brought to the Juventus side has been such a winning mentality that it's shown in the way the team has played. So,
100%.
I think Messi would bring the same type of attitude until he adjusted himself, and then I think you would see a player like Lionel Messi explode. So I think it's ridiculous stuff, if you ask me. Let's go on to more ridiculous Messi stuff, Rob. And that was the comments of Diego Maradona this week on Fox, basically kind of poo-pooing a guy that I think, I want to say 6 months earlier, he was praising and defending. Now he's just kind of just crapping all over him. What do you think of Maradona's comments on Fox?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about a more polarizing figure that clearly changes his mind every so often, you know, he's essentially like one of those people that, like, you know, that accuses them of saying one thing, then saying another thing, and changing his mind so many times, that's Diego Maradona. I mean, yeah, great player, and Jonah, you can agree with this 100%, great player, but, you know, at times, and unfortunately with his age, I believe he's going to turn 58 this month, if I'm not mistaken. I think with age, you know, he's just deteriorating, and it's just a sad sight to see, and we saw at the World Cup, you know, the fact that he was escorted out, I think in the game against Nigeria, you know, and because of heart problems or something around those lines. You know, it's sad to see him deteriorate like that when it comes to words, and to slam a player like Lionel Messi, who's defended for 10 plus years, you know, to say such a thing after the World Cup, I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, it just came out of left field completely. It's something we didn't expect him to do, but again, you know, here's oh my God, I'm losing my mind. Here's Diego Maradona, just, you know, left turn. You know, we joked with each other, Rob, that cocaine is a wonderful drug, right? That's what,
it's a hell of a drug. That's why he made it. That's what Rick James said, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Rick James said that, and now Maradona's proving it true. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. It was just his bizarre comments. I don't know what he was thinking when he said them, but he did come out and say them, and we'll see what, you know. I haven't seen a reaction from Lionel Messi, and to be honest with you, I don't think we will see one.
No.
I think, you know, Messi is too focused on what's going on right now at Barcelona to really care about what's coming out of Diego Maradona's mouth. And I think it should be rightfully so, and this will get kind of swept under the rug, I think, as time moves on. So
definitely.
Let's move on to our last topic of the night we want to talk about, and that is, you know, a story out of MLS. It looks like the Columbus Crew are going to be saved. The Columbus Crew look like they have a buyer. The Haslam family, who currently owns the Cleveland Browns, look like are going to step in and purchase the MLS franchise from Anthony Precourt and Precourt Sport Ventures, who was looking to move the team to Austin, Texas. I think this is a great thing. I think Columbus is going to be saved as a franchise. The one thing that you hate, and this is kind of an MLS-only thing, we would never see Manchester City move out of Manchester, right? It's just...
No.
It's the style of the ownership that allows the MLS clubs to be threatened to be moved or to be folded, where we don't see that in world football. So this is an unusual thing to hear of a club moving, but there was a significant threat of that happening. Now, what it looks like is going to happen from here is that Columbus is going to stay in Columbus, get a new stadium. Precourt is going to be given an MLS franchise to open in the Texas capital of Austin. And it seems like all parties will be happy, but you know, in the end, Rob, is this the right way to do this? Should we look at MLS and say, hey, you know, get it together, because this is not the way you want to expand your league, right?
No, I mean, the stability and, or in this case, instability of a team moving. And, you know, we saw that with problems with Chivas USA. You know, we saw that with many defunct franchises, you know, Miami, Tampa Bay. I mean, certainly we don't want to have that problem again. So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing, too. You know, with other teams coming in and, you know, other teams moving, you kind of want to have that balance in that sense. So, no, it's good for them that they're staying here in Columbus. I think that means a lot to the fans. And I think for Austin, the city of Austin, to have their own type of team, I think would also be content that, you know, you have both parties happy in this moment.
Now, Rob, you know, just to move this a little further, what do you think this means to the people in Detroit, the people in Cincinnati, Nashville, Sacramento? Those are the teams that right now are looking at, you know, getting in as an expansion franchise. What do you think this means for them? Are we going to lose spots because Anthony Precourt kind of backdoored what he wanted to do?
I have no idea. I mean, you know, it all depends. I mean, we still need to see what comes about with the teams of Miami, you know, the team in Nashville, the other team the name escapes me for a second. The one in Cincinnati, we need to wait what happens there before we actually start thinking about the progress. But then you go on to the big question, you know, how much is too much? How much is too much, Joe?
Right, right. Do we end up at 40 teams? Do we?
Yeah, and that's something where, you know, I would be strongly against at this point.
Let me one topic that we weren't going to talk about, but we've got a minute or two extra here tonight, so I think we can just throw it in quickly, and it ties into this, is the talk, again, of Liga MX and MLS combining to make one Super League. How would, if you're Liga MX and you're looking at making a Super League with MLS, which I think would have to absolutely come with promotion relegation, because you're not going to add another 16 teams out of Mexico into 30-some-odd teams in the United States and just think it's all going to be a happy 40, 50-team league. So you've got to think that that comes with promotion relegation. What does that mean for, what does Liga MX say when they look at this situation and say, hey, you guys are adding teams left and right because somebody's writing a big check? That's not the way we do it. Could that possibly sour the potential merger of Liga MX and MLS moving forward?
No, I think on the contrary, I think this is a situation where, you know, Liga MX is thinking big in the sense of not just competing with all the other teams around them in the continent, but to compete as one of the top teams in, you know, compete with the leagues in Europe, you know, the Premier League, your La Ligas, your Liga, Serie A, Bundesliga, those leagues. I think that's the sense. And, you know, again, it's all a money thing. I think certainly when you look at the bid to the 2026 World Cup, that whole kind of thing, I mean, this is certainly a springboard type of thing, where you look at a whole North American league. The one worry I have now is just the dominance, and you feel bad for the rest of the continent, especially in Central America, where, you know, are financially inferior compared to what we see in the United States and Mexico. So I feel bad more for them. But, you know, I think when it comes to both the United States, Mexico, and Canada merging their own league, I think it's more of a money game, but also to compete with with the big leagues in Europe and in the world as, you know, one of the top teams. And also in the Americas, mind you. Also, you know, you have to look at what South America is doing, you know, with their league, you know, falling down in terms of a financial standpoint. You have to look at, you know, Liga MX and MLS trying to, you know, flex their muscles and say, hey, we, you know, we dominate this entire region. You know, we're the best. we're better than Brazil, we're better than Argentina. I think that's the mentality that they want to have when it comes to this kind of move.
Yeah, you also talk about, you know, we've heard your rumblings of MLS teams and Liga MX teams jumping back into the Copa Libertadores and the Copa Sudamericana. I think it could affect all that. So I think MLS would be wise to tread lightly with the expansion and how they expand to make sure that they do it right so that other leagues and countries don't sour on what's going on here in the United States. That would be my two cents there. Rob, so we've got a few matches coming up this week. I'm going to let you pick a match of the week after I give them all, you know, just to say which one would be the top choice. I think there's a few options here. So going back into the Nations League, tomorrow, Tuesday, 2:45 p.m., France-Germany, to see if Germany can kind of get their ship righted here after, you know, some awful, awful performances. It's going to be tough to do against the defending World Cup champions. On Wednesday, 10 p.m., we've got the Vancouver Whitecaps Sporting KC. Vancouver trying to get one of those last spots in MLS playoffs. We're going to have Mike Orr, our good friend Sir Bob, come back in a few weeks and preview the MLS Cup playoffs. So looking forward to that. And then we go back to league coverage. And on Saturday, Chelsea, Manchester United in the EPL, Saturday, 7:30 a.m. The Bundesliga at 9:30 a.m. We'll have Wolfsburg, Bayern Munich. Bayern Munich, another team we've talked about struggling recently. Saturday at 2 p.m., Strasbourg, Monaco, the premier of Thierry Henry at the helm at Monaco. La Liga gives us Barcelona-Sevilla, matchup of the top two teams in the league at 2:45. And on Sunday, the Derby della Madonnina, Inter Milan, AC Milan. AC Milan currently won four straight. Inter Milan are unbeaten in their last five. Going to be really interesting to see how those two teams fare against each other at the San Siro. They're going to have the stage all to themselves on Sunday. Rob, if you had to pick one match that was must-see, which one is it for you?
You know, I mean, I think the obvious many people would say it would be the Milan Derby, where I think there's still that significant gap where Inter is just leading ahead of AC Milan so far in the start of the season. You would also mention, obviously, Chelsea, Manchester United being as big and powerful that those teams are, but Chelsea have also kept that gap between Jose Mourinho's side. Wolfsburg, I think, and Bayern Munich are a really interesting one because of the fact that Bayern are struggling so far and that Wolfsburg can, you know, keep their pace up and try to distance themselves closer to Bayern Munich. But if I had to pick one, I mean, you got to go to the game in Spain where both teams are standing up by 1 point and we could have a new leader by the end of this weekend. I think it's Barcelona-Sevilla, the game to watch this weekend, this week in a sense.
There you go. That's the one to watch then. So,
what about you, Joe?
You know, I mean, obviously for personal reasons, I'm interested in the Milan Derby. I think it's a big one, but I do agree with you. This Barca-Sevilla matchup, especially with Sevilla currently leading the league in La Liga, I know it's early, I get it, but at the same time, to see them at the top of the table there ahead of Barcelona, I think is going to add a little flavor to this matchup. The matchup is at the Camp Nou, so I think, you know, you'll expect Barcelona to come out with guns a-blazing, and we'll see. I think we could see a high-scoring match in this one, Rob. I think a 3-2 result Barcelona's way would not be out of the question in this one, so probably the most exciting one to see. Let's get back to the trivia question. So I'd given it to you earlier. There are six teams that qualified for every World Cup. The United States going to their eighth World Cup. They are one of the teams that qualified for all of them. Can you give me the other five teams that have qualified for all eight tournaments?
Right. Off the bat, I'm going to give you Brazil.
Brazil is one.
Norway.
Norway is two.
Sweden.
Three.
Germany.
Four.
Canada?
No.
Oof.
For seven of the eight.
Oh yeah, of course. China.
No, seven of the eight as well. But the final choice, the one you're missing, is a champion. They've won the tournament.
Japan.
So you're six teams that have qualified for eight women's World Cups. United States also have played the most matches, 43. They've won the most matches, 33 as well. Germany, Norway, Sweden, Brazil, and Japan. The six teams that have qualified for all eight FIFA's Women's World Cups. So that's our trivia question for the night. So, Rob, I'm winded from yelling into my microphone. I've kind of had enough of it.
Need some water, my friend.
Oh, tell me about it. So without any further ado, let's hit the closing music.
Yes, sir.
All right. And just so you can hear me, I'm going to have to keep that turned down pretty low. But for episode 220 of Low Limit Football, special thanks again to Ante Jukic from Guardian Australia for joining us tonight. Next week, we're going to get back into league coverage. We're going to preview some Champions League and Europa League matchups. And we're also going to get back to talking Copa Libertadores as they jump into their semifinals. So for episode 220 of Low Limit Football, I am Joe Uccello.
I'm Roberto Rojas.
Thank you for listening, everyone, and good night.